Okay, so let's continue where we left off last Thursday. We'll wrap up what I wanted to say about the FRW universe, and then we'll start talking about the thermal history of the universe, and that'll be our next topic. Okay, so we started from the metric, which we got under the assumption of homogeneity and isotropy. And then for the moment, I asked us to focus on the case where the spatial curvature is zero, so for a flat universe. And the matter content, last time we looked at single particle geodesics, but then we went on to discuss perfect fluids, which had a stress tensor that was described by the energy density and the pressure of a perfect fluid. And I try really hard to put little hats on my peas to make sure they're peas and not rows, because I know if I don't do that, my rows look just like peas. But usually we have to supplement this energy momentum tensor with some relationship between pressure and energy density. And so we typically do that for fluids in cosmology with some constant W, the equation of state parameter, where W is zero for collisionless matter, W is a third for a gas of relativistic particles, and W is minus one for a cosmological constant, and those are kind of the most important ones that we have to contend with. So if we plug this energy momentum tensor and this metric into the equation for conservation of stress energy, we ended up with this equation, which is the continuity equation that tells us how energy densities dilute with the expansion of the universe. Okay? And so here, as long as W was bigger than minus one, then the right-hand side of this equation is negative. That implies that densities decrease with time. In other words, fluids dilute with expansion, which is kind of the usual property we think of a fluid might have if it lived in a growing box, say. And the solution to this equation was a power law, when like a to the minus three, one plus W. Okay, so that was how matter behaved in an expanding universe. And then we also derived the equation for how the expansion is affected by the matter that is contained in the Robertson-Walker universe. So we got that by solving Einstein's equations. And the result of solving Einstein's equations, which is sort of where we got to last time, okay, so we got one equation from the Einstein equations that had to do with the first derivative of the scale factor, okay, and that related that to got
you are in the Zoom meeting now.
For the second derivative of the scale factor. And that one looked like this. So this was related to the acceleration we can think of the universe. And one thing I forgot to say last time is that we can clearly see now what type of stuff we need to fill the universe in order that it undergoes either decelerated expansion if the right-hand side is negative, or accelerated expansion if the right-hand side is positive. So for W, bigger than minus one-third, the right-hand side of this equation will be negative. For W less than minus one-third, it will be positive. So from this equation, we see that for W less than minus a third, one-third, we get accelerated expansion, meaning that A dot increases with time, and W bigger than one-third, minus one-third, we get decelerated, or how about decelerating, to use an actual English word, expansion. Okay, so W equals minus a third is kind of an interesting threshold. Okay, and then from here, W equals minus one was kind of an interesting threshold. Okay, if we go back here and we look at the kind of normal stuff that we consider in cosmology, you could see that from this menu, if I have matter or radiation only, then that would lead to a decelerating universe. But if I had a cosmological constant, lambda, that would lead to an accelerating universe. And as it turns out, the way to include curvature, at least at the level of this equation right here, is to consider a perfect fluid that has W equals minus one-third. So as it turns out, curvature is sort of the thing that leads to coasting. The universe is neither accelerating nor decelerating. So we'll put that on our list here. Okay, so then I think we ended last time by solving these equations for a single perfect fluid. If we have a perfect fluid with just one component, as we've written kind of implicitly here. So we found that the solution was the following. We can normalize things to some constant, T naught, which we're going to say is the age of the universe, so that at the present day, A equals 1. And then it's also a power law solution where the appropriate power was 2 over 3. 1 plus W. Okay, so T naught was the age of the universe. And for convenience, we could express T naught in terms of the Hubble parameter evaluated at T naught. It's called the Hubble constant. So that gave us 2H naught inverse over 3, 1 plus W, okay, where H naught is just defined by A dot over A evaluated at T naught. Okay, so from this, we can go back to our menu over there. And we see that the bigger W is, the younger the universe is. Okay, so if I have a universe with only matter, then to get to the same value of the scale factor, A equals 1 from T equals 0 takes me longer, okay, than it does for, say, radiation. Okay. And of course, this solution breaks down. Because if W is really minus 1, then, A is equal to e to the h naught t, and the age of the universe is by this definition, t is negative. So if we were to fix that, then we could just make this t minus t naught. T naught's whatever we want in this case. Okay, so that was the recap of what we did last time. Were there any questions that you had or that came up after thinking about it? over the weekend. Okay. If not, then let's go ahead. So the next thing we can do is just kind of a trivial generalization of what we had above, which is to consider fluids that have multiple components, okay? Okay, and now, why don't we just put back in the curvature term that we would have gotten had we not assumed flatness and solved the Einstein equation. So I'll just tell you the answer, and if you're interested, you can go back and derive that. Okay, so this first Friedmann equation now becomes a sum over all the different components that I might consider. So I have a bunch of different fluids, each of which is described by an energy density rho I. And if we had curvature, then the appropriate thing to put here is this, where kappa is plus minus 1 or 0, just as before. And r is this constant that defined the radius of curvature on the spatial slice. So how big of a piece of this universe do I have to look at before I notice that it's actually curved? OK, so that's just the general equation. And then each of these fluids would satisfy their own conservation law, just like the one above. Okay, so that still holds independently for each of these perfect fluids. And now we could just take this equation and kind of rearrange it a little bit. And let's consider the stuff that we think our universe is made of. So matter, radiation, and a cosmological constant. So if I multiply by a squared over 2, and I put this on the left-hand side of the equation, then I get something that looks like a dot squared over 2 plus 4 pi g over 3. Okay, and then in here, I've got minus rho matter evaluated today. Okay, so this goes like for matter, 1 over a cubed. So if I multiply by a squared, I get 1 over a. So it goes like 1 over a cubed. So if I multiply by a squared, I get 1 over a. There's radiation. That goes like 1 over a to the fourth. So if I multiply it by a squared, I get 1 over a squared. There's lambda. That's constant in time. So for lambda w equals minus 1, that equation d rho dt equals 0. So rho is a constant. And then in principle, I could have curvature. And that goes like 3 kappa over 8 pi g newton times r squared. Okay, and then, you know, invent whatever other exotic stuff you want. And then we set this equal to 0. Okay, so why do we write it like this? Because now this looks like an equation that we could, in principle, solve based on just our intuition. It's the conservation of energy for a particle with unit mass and a potential that looks like this. Okay. So we could just call this some effective potential that's a function of position A. Okay, so we invent this fictitious particle with unit mass, and we say it evolves in this potential, okay, described by this. So let's draw what that looks like. Okay, so the total energy is 0 for this particle, right? So that means if we draw a diagram that's supposed to represent the energy as a function of A, the trajectory of the particle will just follow this axis, OK? okay, whatever it does. Okay, so let's look at the different contributions. So we can see that matter and radiation go to minus infinity as A goes to zero. So these contributions to the effective potential look kind of like this. Okay, they would have a different slope depending on if it's matter or radiation, but qualitatively they would look like that. If we look at lambda, it goes like minus A squared. So it goes to minus infinity as A goes to infinity. So lambda does something like this. And then if we look at the effect of curvature, it's just to take the whole thing and move it up or down, right? So if I have a positive curvature, then I get to add a positive constant. So I push the whole potential up. If I have a negative curvature, I take the whole thing and I push it down. Right. So we could then take here kappa equals plus 1, and it will move the whole thing down. Kappa is minus 1. Okay, and so if we were to sum up all of these different components, then we're going to get a shape that's dominated by matter and lambda, or sorry, matter and radiation, and then turns over at some point and gets dominated by lambda, except for it doesn't look like that because they add. So silly me. Looks more like this. So it's the red line. It's not really great. Sorry. My drawing skills could be better. Okay, so let's think about the trajectory of this fictitious particle. So if we start out at A equals zero, that's the Big Bang, right? So the universe, if it has A dot greater than zero, starts expanding, right? So the universe starts expanding, but it's kind of trying to get up this hill, right? So it's decelerating. Okay, until eventually we get to a point where we overcome the maximum. And then if we keep going, we'll start falling down this hill, and so we'll be accelerating, okay? And so in a flat universe, that's with these ingredients what happens. We start by decelerating, and then as soon as lambda comes to dominate the energy density of the universe, we start accelerating. Yeah?
I think you were right with the previous red line. If both are negative, then the sum of them is more negative.
That's true. Thanks, Juan. Yes. Good life lesson. Like, just do stuff and don't think about it. It's probably right. If you think about it, you're probably going to get it wrong. All right, so, but now that you're armed with this knowledge, we can think about all sorts of weird universes that have different kind of strange expansion histories. So, for example, consider the following strange universe. If I add just exactly the right amount of curvature, of positive curvature, right, I can take that whole potential and I can shift it up so that it just kisses zero as such, right? And now there's a solution at the top of this hill that is static, That's called the Einstein static universe. And that was why Einstein invented the cosmological constant, because he wanted a universe that was static forever. And so if I add just the right amount of positive curvature, I have lambda and I have matter or radiation, then I can make a solution that looks like this. Okay? But as you can see from this picture, and as I asked you to show in your homework, I believe, this is an unstable equilibrium, because if I make the scale factor just a little bit bigger, it's going to fall off to infinite positive scale factor. And if I make the scale factor a little bit smaller, it's going to crunch to zero, right? Okay, another kind of interesting case you can do is if I add even more positive curvature, then I can get a solution that looks like this. Okay, and now there's two types of universes, right? There are ones that expand from zero size, reach a maximum, and then recontract to zero size. But there are also solutions that start infinitely big, reach a minimum size, and then re-expand to be infinitely big. Okay? And so here, there's no singularity. Right? There's no Big Bang in this model. So we can have an expanding universe that never contracts to zero size. Sometimes called a bounce. And no exotic ingredients necessary. You just need lambda, positive curvature, and matter radiation. Question?
Yeah. That means, though, that we have like a minimal radius of the universe.
Yep.
Is that like with numbers? Is that really constraining on our parameters compared to what we see? Or was it likely that it could have been smaller than it was? Like,
yeah, so this probably doesn't work in our universe, because I can't add enough positive curvature to actually make the potential look like this without being in folly with current constraints. However, we could invent some convoluted cosmology where you have some period in the early universe that, well, maybe we can do this. I don't even know if you can do this. Maybe you can do this where you have some period in the early universe where you have one value of lambda, and then at later times you can, let's say lambda can evolve and it can evolve to a different value. Then maybe you can make it look like this, and then you can get some, you know, thing. But like at face value, this doesn't work with our cosmology, yeah, with our observation, because we don't measure any significant curvature. But I mean, I should say, you know, a lot of the business of thinking about early universe cosmology is to think about, you know, if we go really far back, like where we're talking about like a Planck time after the Big Bang, then in principle, this came from Einstein's equations, but Einstein's equations should be corrected. And in some models or in some theories of quantum gravity, those corrections give rise to terms that do similar things and prevent the universe from reaching a zero scale factor. And then you get a bounce from that. Okay, but you can play with this, and you can see for a given set of ingredients by drawing these pictures sort of qualitatively what types of solutions come out. Okay. Now, if you want to actually solve this and get the scale factor as a function of time, that's possible to get analytic results for matter and radiation, matter and lambda, but not matter radiation in lambda, as far as I know. I don't think there's an exact analytic solution for that. And so then you just need to solve this numerically. Okay, so any questions about this? Yep.
I mean, technically, there is no solution to this when A is equal to 0.
Indeed. And when A equals 0, if we were to evaluate the Ricci scalar for the FRW metric, we'd find it blows up. So, indeed.
So then, is it fair to make any conclusions within this framework about like A equal to 0?
Nope. Yeah. Yeah. Not really fair, right? We extrapolate. And we say A gets really small, and then, you know, we think that the corrections to Einstein's equations organize themselves like powers of curvature divided by M Planck, then at some point those kick in, and then depending on, you know, if it's string theory or loop quantum gravity or whatever, there's different corrections that come up, and they do different things. And so since we don't really know what the right theory of quantum gravity is, it's, yeah, absolutely not fair to think about what happens with certainty at A equals 0. We just don't know. Other questions? Okie dokie. All right, so just a few more words. Okay, briefly, last time we defined something called the density parameter omega. Which we defined as the density by something called the critical density, divided by something called the critical density, where the critical density was defined by whatever the density needs to be in order to wrong board. In order to give me h squared equals this. In other words, no curvature. Okay? Okay, so when omega equals 1 from the equation above and these definitions, that implies that kappa is 0. Okay, so there's no curvature. More generally, we can define the Friedmann equation as this simple expression, where omega k is then just minus kappa over h squared r squared a squared. And another convenient way of rewriting the Friedmann equation in terms of these density parameters is to take the Friedmann equation, divide by h today squared. H today squared can be related to the critical density today. Okay. And so then we can write the Friedmann equation entirely in terms of the energy density in different components of the universe, or the density parameter for different components evaluated today, just divided by the appropriate powers of the scale factor. So, for example, in our universe, got radiation, got baryonic matter, got cold dark matter. Those go like 1 over a cubed. We've got dark energy. And then in principle, we might have curvature. Okay, So just with these definitions, that's kind of a convenient, nice way of rewriting the Friedmann equation. Okay. And typically, if we look at cosmological parameter constraints, we don't constrain the energy density, but we actually constrain omega today in these different components. And I'm going to be lazy, and forever on, I will not write an O. But whenever I write an omega, it's going to just be understood as that's the value of this today. So if we look at the different components, there's radiation. There's two types of radiation in our universe, photons and neutrinos. Those are the two light particles. This is like 9 times 10 to the minus 5. Okay, so one part in like 10,000, roughly speaking, of the critical density. Cold dark matter. Is like 0.26. Baryonic matter, so atoms or anything that's not dark matter, is 0.0493. Dark energy gets the biggest share, 0.685. And the current best constraint on omega k is that it's got to be less than 0.0037. Okay. So this is the measured energy budget as of 2018, mostly constrained by the Planck satellite from the CMB. We'll talk about how we get those constraints at some point if you take part two. Right, but we could draw the pie chart that you always see now. So, you know, you get like more than that, I guess. More than half. Let's draw it like that. So 68% of the universe is dark energy in terms of the critical density. Cold dark matter is like 26%. Baryonic matter is 4%, 5%, and then photons and neutrinos are some tiny little wedge. It's like a 10,000th of a, you know, 0.01%. Okay, so that's where this pie chart comes from. It's just literally using these omegas. Okay, they sum to 1 because the universe is almost flat. If the universe wasn't almost flat, then we wouldn't have the only scientific manifestation of a pie chart in physics. It's hard to imagine other places where you actually draw a pie chart. But thanks to the universe being flat, we can use pie charts for science. Okay, good. So just a few more things. Okay, so from here, just from these definitions, we can also think for the multi-component fluid case of several interesting times. So there will be a time in the past, right? Radiation dominates when A is small, but then eventually matter can compete with radiation as A gets bigger. And so we can define the time of matter-radiation equality. As when omega cold dark matter plus omega baryon over omega radiation. Well, I'm cheating now. I'm actually doing what I said I would never do. When this is equal to omega radiation over a to the fourth. This combination we will often call omega matter. Okay, and we can see that solving for the scale factor at which this happens, A equality is just omega radiation over omega matter, okay? That's equal to 1 over 1 plus the redshift at matter radiation equality, which is another thing that's probably more useful, actually. So that solving for that, Z equality is omega matter over omega radiation minus 1. And if we plug in the numbers on that board, we get something like 3,400. Okay. So at a redshift of like 3,400, matter becomes more important than radiation. We can also solve for the time at which dark energy starts to compete with matter, because that doesn't dilute at all. So as matter dilutes like 1 over a cubed, eventually dark energy will catch up. So we can call that, okay, so we solve for where omega matter over a cubed is equal to omega dark energy. Let me just be consistent with notation. Right, so we can solve for that. And that is equal to omega matter over omega dark energy to the 1/3 power. And we could also solve for the redshift when that happens. And if we do that and plug in the numbers, this is something like 0.3. So remember, a typical galaxy survey can probe redshifts of order 1, okay? So bigger than a galaxy survey of the order of a galaxy survey, right? So for most of the history of the universe, we can consider it to be matter dominated. And then only recently is it really become dominated by dark energy. All right, so that is the Robertson-Walker universe. That's everything we need to know about its geometry and its evolution. So before we go on to the thermal history of the universe, are there any questions about this? Okay, take that as a no. All right, so let's change track now and talk about the thermal history of the universe. So so in our universe, we saw from these pictures that if we extrapolate backwards in time, A was really tiny, the densities were absolutely enormous, and so in general, things were very dense. We can also infer that they were probably very hot, because typically when I take normal fluids and I put them in small spaces, they get hot. We'll see that that's true here too. But in general, if this is redshift, this is time. Things started hot and dense, and then they became cold and diffuse. And so we can think about the different processes, physical processes that we imagine might have happened at different energies, right? So we can map hot and dense to higher energy. So we could draw another arrow here, energy. Okay, so eventually we touched on this. Quantum gravity, God knows what that is. So big question marks, and I don't really know how we do physics there, although we try very hard. But there's going to be big error bars here on our predictions. And then there's lots and lots of different physical models. But eventually we come down from all the question marks to the electroweak scale. And that's at energies of order a TeV. And we understand a reasonable amount about electroweak physics. Okay? And so we can start to infer things at this point about what could have happened given the known physical laws in the early universe. There's still a few question marks, but we can do a reasonable job. As the universe gets a little bit more cold and diffuse, we get down to scales relevant for QCD, like the confinement scale. So the energy at which quarks behave as free particles and are not bound up inside nucleons. Those are energy scales of order like 100 MeV. Okay, if we get cooler and more diffuse, we get down to the scales associated with nuclear physics. Those are scales of like an MeV. Yes?
When you talk about energy scale, is it the energy of, it's the energy of what? Is that the whole universe?
Yeah, well, no, I'm not talking about that. So forget about cosmology for the moment. And let's just think about what, just from dimensional analysis, what is the characteristic energy scale associated with different types of physics? Okay, so at the electroweak scale, the physical thing that I'm talking about here would be like, what's the mass of the Higgs boson? Or what are the typical energies needed to access, how do I make Higgses? Okay, and the LHC needed to get to energies of roughly a TeV to do that efficiently. So we can say that the scale of physics associated with the electroweak scale is like 100 TeV, roughly speaking, or 1 TeV, sorry, roughly speaking. QCD, we could characterize that by the confinement scale. It's a physical scale. That's like 100 MeV. Nuclear physics, an MeV. So I need to give particles roughly an MeV of kinetic energy in order to make fusion happen. Or if I have fission, the typical energies that are released is of order 1 MeV. So that's what I mean, like sort of typical physical processes that characterize these different types of physics. What energy scales do they have?
One more question.
Yeah?
So is it not correct to assume these are poor particle energies as the universe sort of cools down? Like the, you know, this category that they start falling in. And if I, are we actually going down all the way to CMB, which is the least energy?
Well, the thing you said is roughly correct. So when the typical particle energies in the universe have these different scales, that is when these different physics will be relevant. So we will make that connection in just a second. But right now, I'm just writing different energy scales associated with different physics.
All right. Thank you.
Uh-huh. And then finally, we get down to sort of atomic physics scales. You could think of this like, what's the binding energy for hydrogen? You know, like EV scales. Okay, so all the stuff below about here. So let's put three lines. Okay, this is all not understood, I would say. This is sort of understood. There's a lot of uncertainties because QCD is really hard to solve. We need to solve it on computers, so we don't really know everything we'd like to know about QCD. Electroweak is hard because we just found the Higgs boson. We still don't really know all the properties of the electroweak sector. We don't know the physics that's responsible for hierarchy problem, and et cetera, et cetera. So there's still some question marks here. But this stuff down here, we can say is really well understood. So I'm going to focus here. Okay. And there's lots of literature on everything that comes above, but let's stay grounded and talk about this stuff for now. Okay, and the two things that we're going to talk about associated with nuclear physics and atomic physics are Big Bang, nucleosynthesis, BBN. So this will be our one MeV scale stuff. And the second thing we're going to talk about, recombination. That's when we can think of this as when protons and neutrons end up as atoms, or nuclei, let's be better about that, atomic nuclei. And we can think of recombination that happens on roughly EV scales as when nuclei and electrons turn into neutral atoms. Okay. This one's really important because recombination coincides with the birth of the CMB, the cosmic microwave background radiation. So this will be our first contact with that concept. Okay, so that's kind of the big picture. But now, before we do anything else, we need math to describe ensembles of interacting particles in an expanding universe. Okay, luckily such math exists. And it's all based on an object defined in phase space. Okay, so phase space is defined as six-dimensional space. Okay, so it's the three dimensions of position and the three dimensions of the conjugate momentum to this position, defined as we do in Hamiltonian mechanics. So what we can do is we can take an element of phase space. Okay? If we have a single particle that lives in phase space, that particle will take some trajectory through phase space, where the trajectory is governed by the laws of motion. In this case, they would be governed by the geodesic equation from general relativity in this expanding universe. Okay, we can take then ensembles of these particles, okay, in some volume of phase space, and ask the question, can we describe statistically, at least, how this ensemble of particles changes in time? Okay. And so at any given instant in time, we can define basically just the number of states in a volume of phase space. Okay. So that number of states can be written as some arbitrary function of x, p, and time times some measure, which you might remember from statistical mechanics. So the basic unit a phase space has size 1 over 2 pi h bar cubed, right? So this is the same measure over phase space that we usually see in StatMech. So here, it's just the number of states. We just count. This is the distribution function. And here in this measure, we need to be a little bit careful. So what we would really like is that this thing, because we're working in general relativity, does not care what coordinate system I'm in. So we need to make sure that this is really invariant under coordinate transformations. So we will not prove, but one can show that. If we define x vector as the spatial components of the position 4 vector, and we define p vector as the spatial projection of the thing that we called momentum last time, okay? That was the derivative of the position 4 vector with respect to some affine parameter. Then we're good, okay? So with these definitions, then given the normalization of that thing we called the momentum before, which was minus m squared, we find that we get a factor of here, a squared, and that cancels out the a squared that appeared before, so that the normalization now is the sort of usual one. Okay, m squared is e squared minus p vector squared. Okay, so with these choices, one can show that this this volume in phase space is invariant under coordinate transformations, so it's fine for use in GR. Okay. Okay, so that's just a bunch of definitions so far. And the distribution function is really useful because it allows us to count. Okay, so we could do things like define the number density of particles in real space by just integrating the phase space distribution, right? So the number density, we can define in general as the integral over momenta of the differential number per unit volume, okay, which from here is just the integral d cubed p over 2 pi cubed of the distribution function. Okay, so if we just take the distribution function integrated over all momenta, it tells us about the number density of particles. Yeah.
So for the on-shell equation, it should be m squared equals to e squared minus p squared over a squared. Because g, I mean, the metric is a squared, so it can not only cancel, but give an additional a squared.
No, I think it works out. So, so I think that was what we had before.
Yes.
Yep. Okay, so then from this, we're going to get e squared minus e squared.
Yes.
Plus a squared d that, right? Okay, so now let's plug this guy in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So if I take 1 over that, I get a 1 over a squared.
Yes.
So then this becomes minus e squared plus a squared e vector over a squared.
Why p over a but not p?
Because that's a squared. So if I then define p vector in terms of this derivative,
yes.
I get a 1 over a. Make sense?
Yes.
Yes. Oh, no, but you're right. There's an extra a squared. Sorry. No, we're not quite there yet. Man, I see your problem. Because the way I've written it there,
yes,
you're right.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Well, let me think about it. Well, let's talk afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Sorry, for this number density formula, do you need the factor of dp cubed? This, because in dn you have already a factor of dp.
Well, no, I'm just finding the differential number for unit volume. And that's defined as the phase space distribution. Oh, yeah, you're right, thanks. Cheers. Yeah, thank you. Okay, so we get to count, we get the number density. We can get the energy density. By just taking a weighted integral. So we can take the distribution function times the energy, right? And then integrate that to get the energy density. And so on and so forth, where this E, if I've done it correctly, is defined by this equation right here. Okay. So in the absence of any interactions, then each particle in this ensemble is just going to undergo geodesic motion, right? And a consequence of that is basically that, in analogy with Liouville's theorem in classical mechanics, then the volume on phase space is conserved. And therefore, the distribution function should not change with evolution along geodesics. The only subtlety is that we have to remember that the thing that evolves you along geodesics is not time, but the affine parameter. So with that subtlety, consequence of basically the conservation laws, so the usual conservation of stress energy, is that the distribution does not change under geodesic motion. Volumes in phase space are conserved. And this gets a name. So this is called the collisionless Boltzmann equation. It's extremely useful. So don't let the simplicity fool you. This is a total derivative, right? And remember that in general, the distribution function can be a function of x, p, and the affine parameter, right? If we use that to parameterize time. Okay, so this is really a complicated partial differential equation. Okay, if we add interactions, well now, if something comes along and hits a particle, it can move its position in phase space. And so in general, in the presence of interactions, the phase space volume is not conserved, right? And so the right-hand side of this equation is not zero. Schematically, in this situation, we just put something on the right-hand side, okay? And now in general, we have to deal with the fact that when there's interactions, maybe there's multiple species of particles, right? So one particle one can interact with particle two. And so we should put an index on here to indicate that in the presence of interactions, it can be interesting to consider multiple species. Okay. So now we get a set of equations called the Boltzmann equations, just not collisionless, Boltzmann equations, that describe the evolution of the distribution function for all the species that we might care about. Okay, and we're going to come back to the Boltzmann equation in different contexts again and again and again. It's a very useful way of describing the relevant physics. Okay, so without being more specific, that's it, right? That's the kind of big picture. Okay, we work with this distribution function over phase space, and we basically want to know how it evolves as the universe evolves. So today, we can specialize to a homogeneous universe. We can do better. We can specialize to a homogeneous and isotropic universe. And this implies that the distribution function can only really be a function of the magnitude of P and the affine parameter, right? If it was a function of position, the universe would not be homogeneous. Okay? If it was a function of the direction of P, the universe would not be isotropic. And so in order for the universe to be isotropic, the distribution function should only be a function of the magnitude of P and time. So in this special scenario, we can integrate the Boltzmann equation and get an expression for the number densities and not these sort of differential numbers over phase space. Okay, so we can integrate the Boltzmann equations in this special case. Okay, so let's start with the left-hand side. Okay, so we have dF d lambda, total derivatives. But now we know what f is a function of. It's only a function of p, and instead of lambda, let's say t, the coordinate time, okay? It's the same thing, I'm just trading one for the other, right? So then we can write this total derivative as the derivative of t with respect to lambda times the partial derivative of f with respect to t plus the derivative of p with respect to lambda times the partial derivative of f with respect to p. Okay, and now we can use some of the things that we derived last time for an FRW universe. So last time, remember, we showed that dt d lambda with the normalizations that I've chosen, which are hopefully correct, gives me E. Okay, so that's one thing we knew from last time. And then the other thing we knew from last time is that the geodesic equation told us that in an FRW universe, dPd lambda was just minus h times p. I think I got that right. Times e. I think the e came from dp dt. Let's roll with that for a minute.
So h is Hubble constant?
What's that?
H is
Hubble constant, a dot over a. Yeah, that's right. I've got that lecture here. Let me check that real quick. I need an E there. All right, let's roll with this for a minute. Okay, so we can substitute back in here. We get an E df dt, and then we get a minus h e df dp. So we can factor out the E. Okay, we're left with this. Okay, and so then this is equal to this collisional term that we haven't yet said anything about on the right-hand side. Okay, so now let's take this equation. Let's put the E with this collisional term, and then let's integrate this over momentum. So let's work on the left-hand side. The right-hand side, we're just going to leave alone. So this partial derivative with respect to t can come out of the integral. That is just the number density. So that's what that term ends up doing. Okay, and then we've got this term here. So h is a function of time. And then we have d cubed p over 2 pi cubed p df dp. This guy you can integrate by parts to get rid of the p and get rid of the integral, or sorry, get rid of the derivative on this guy. So this ends up being, we get a sign change from that integration by parts. We get a factor of 3, because this is the magnitude of the momentum. We get a p squared, so we get a p cubed. We take one away, we get a 3. So this gives us a plus 3h at the end of the day. D cubed p, 2 pi cubed f. And then again, this gives us just the number density. Okay, so we have dn dt plus 3hn. That's a dot over a. And so I can use the chain rule to stick these two terms together and write this as 1 over a cubed d a cubed n dt. So if you expand that out, you'll get this expression right here. Okay. And then I haven't done anything to the right-hand side. So that's still just this integral d cubed p over 2 pi cubed e times this collisional term. OK, now challenge to you guys. I did this derivation like 3 times last night. I cannot figure out why there's not a 2 here. Because really, we should have the invariant measure over base space, right, or over the p, right? And to do that, I need a 2. I don't know. You can help me find out why I don't have a 2 there. I'd be grateful. In all the textbooks, there's a 2 there.
I think this might supposed to be a 2 in the dp d lambda. Is from the Friedman or from the
geodesic
equation.
Oh, thank you, Ian. Yeah. So there should be a 2 here?
I think so. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, thanks. I'll go back and I'll try that. Or if you want to try it and show me, that'd be awesome. Okay. But this is sort of the master equation for everything that we want to talk about now. Okay? So this is some integrated version of the basic thing, which was the Boltzmann equation. And now we can, we can do stuff. Okay, so we can't really do much without assuming something about f. Okay, and so the place we're going to start is to think about what the distribution function is in equilibrium. Okay, so when interactions are frequent, you can think of this as thermal, sometimes called kinetic, equilibrium. So just have a gas of particles in contact with a heat bath, so they bounce off the walls of some container and they interact with that strongly enough that they can exchange energy with that heat bath. In equilibrium, when interactions are frequent, then we all know that the distribution function approaches either a Bose-Einstein distribution or Fermi-Dirac. Okay, so plus if I have fermions, minus if I have bosons, G is a degeneracy factor. So for example, it counts the spin states of particles. So for photons, it would be 2. For fermions, it would be 2. For spin 1, it would be 3, and so on and so forth. E is the energy defined over there, and mu is the chemical potential. so if mu is equal to zero, we are also in chemical equilibrium, okay? Meaning the number of particles doesn't change. Okay? The number of particles of different species doesn't change. Okay, and then we can start to do things with this distribution function, at least in equilibrium. So for example, we could calculate number densities, this most basic thing. And then of course, there's two interesting regimes, the relativistic regime and the non-relativistic regime. In the in-between regime, there's no exact solution, but that's okay. So in the relativistic regime, E equals P. So the number density is just the degeneracy factor integral over momentum. And then we have E to the P over T plus or minus 1. OK. I think I only wrote down on my paper the solution for minus 1. So let's put that there and do this for bosons. So this is 1.2, roughly speaking, times this degeneracy factor over pi times t cubed. And there's also a solution for plus. I just don't remember it off the top of my head. We could think about non-relativistic particles, okay? Okay, so now E is roughly equal to the rest mass plus P squared over 2m, the ultra non-relativistic limit. If we also consider temperatures that are smaller than m, then we can simplify the distribution quite a bit. So basically then this term is way, way bigger than 1. And so the distribution function is now just the Boltzmann distribution. We don't care about the Fermi or Dirac statistics. So now we could do this integral dqp over 2 pi cubed. And we just get the chemical potential splitting up that Boltzmann factor e to the minus m over t. Those two could come out of the integral, so they don't depend on p. And then there's the minus p squared over 2mt. So that's just a Gaussian integral over the magnitude of p. We can do that exactly. So this is just the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. Should look familiar from StatMech 2. Okay, so number densities, we know if the universe expands, go like 1 over a cubed, yeah? So from this, we learn that for relativistic particles, the temperature goes like 1 over the scale factor. Okay. For non-relativistic particles, the story is a bit complicated because I've got this exponential. But at leading order, it goes like t to the 3/2 power. And so that implies that t's got to go like 1 over a squared if the number density want to go like 1 over a cubed. Okay, so given this assumption about the distribution function that we're at or near kinetic or thermal equilibrium, then we can evaluate these number densities. I just say one more thing before we end. So there's a related thing we could do, which is, let's say the following happens. I have some particle, it's in perfect thermal equilibrium, and then I just get rid of the heat bath, okay, so that it's no longer interacting with anything. So then this distribution will be set up. I will have this equilibrium distribution function, and I can ask what happens to it as a function of time. Okay. So the relevant thing to do then is to solve this collisionless Boltzmann equation, right? So it's, I've got the distribution function. I just want to know how it evolves in time. And it's not interacting with anything. So the right-hand side is 0. We can turn that d d lambda into a d dt by using dt d lambda. Gives us e. Then the distribution function, we can see, is a function of temperature and energy. Okay, let's forget about the chemical potential for now. So this is really e partial F partial temperature dT dT plus partial F partial E dE dT. We can use the fact that the distribution function depends in this really simple way on E and T to rearrange this ever so slightly. So we could factor out the df de. We get this because df de over df dt is just that. We can then use the geodesic equation, which, dear God, I hope I got that right, because if I didn't, then photons are going to redshift like a squared. Okay, and this is really dA dt, so 1 over a dA dt. The E can come out. So that gives me a 1 over T, a 1 over A. Okay, and this is better equal to 0. So that implies that temperature goes like 1 over A here. Okay, so both in equilibrium and when I have a distribution function that's given by the above, and it doesn't interact with anything, the temperature goes like 1 over A. That'll be relevant for the CMB, because the CMB was formed by a bunch of photons in thermal equilibrium with electrons, and then they stopped talking to the electrons and just evolved. So we see that when that happens, nothing happens to the distribution function, except for the temperature goes like 1 over A, but it maintains the same form. That would be important later. OK, so that's all we got time for. Any questions yet?
How did you get, again, the step from d over dt to,
there? Yeah, so again, that was the geodesic equation, which I'm claiming we can write as minus h e to be checked. Okay, so next time we'll come back to this master equation, and then we'll see how we can use this to think about the physics of BBN and the physics of recombination. Okay, thank you.